Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present retired Navy Commander Beth Coy, who talks about the congressional vote to repeal the Pentagon's Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy that barred gays and lesbians from serving openly in the U.S. military. Cindy Rank of the West Virginia Highlands Conservancy, who talks about her group's campaign to better regulate natural gas wells drilled by the controversial method known as hydraulic fracturing or fracking. And Kim Ives, an editor with the newspaper Haiti Liberté, who discusses the outcome of Haiti's disputed November election and prospects that responsible leadership could emerge to lead Haiti out of its multifaceted crises. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
According to U.S. diplomatic cables disclosed by WikiLeaks, American diplomats in India were aware of torture techniques regularly used by Indian security services in Kashmir, where an Islamic insurgency has been gaining ground in the disputed territory. U.S. diplomats were briefed in 2005 by the International Committee of the Red Cross about Indian abuses such as electrocutions, beatings, and sexual humiliation employed against hundreds of detainees. American diplomats continued to be concerned about the actions of Indian security services and stopped a pro-Indian paramilitary leader from traveling to the U.S. because he was implicated in rape, extortion, and extrajudicial killings. According to the Guardian newspaper, which posted the leaked cables about Kashmir, the revelation was an embarrassment to the New Delhi government, which takes pride in being the world's largest democracy and is seeking closer ties to the U.S. Red Cross officials made 177 visits to Indian detention centers in Kashmir between 2002 and 2004, where they interviewed nearly 1,300 prisoners. In nearly half the cases, the Red Cross found the detainees were mistreated. Over 600 detainees showed signs of enduring various kinds of torture. The U.S. cable noted, detainees were rarely militants, but persons connected to or believed to have information about the insurgency. India denies engaging in torture. New Delhi Al Jazeera correspondent Prerna Suri observed the Indian military has broad power in Kashmir to detain people indiscriminately through the Armed Forces Special Act. 2010 saw the demise of cap-and-trade legislation in Congress to combat global warming. The bill died, ironically, in the aftermath of the massive BP oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico, when eco-activists should have been on the offensive. Instead, environmental lobbyists got trapped in tactical maneuvering in the U.S. Senate as public interest in climate change waned when the economy imploded. According to the news magazine In These Times, the collapse of the climate bill in the Senate exposed the misguided strategy of major environmental groups. In 2006, Fred Krupp, head of the Environmental Defense Fund, forged a political alliance with utility companies and big business to reach a consensus for a cap-and-trade carbon emissions regime. Momentum grew after Barack Obama was elected president on a platform of calling for more clean energy jobs. In June 2009, the Democratic-led House of Representatives passed the watered-down Waxman-Markey bill, but the cap-and-trade legislation stalled in the Senate. Grassroots climate groups like 350.org and Friends of the Earth blasted the bill as too weak to stop rising levels of greenhouse gas and higher global temperatures. The green enthusiasm gap grew after President Obama accepted the expansion of offshore oil drilling as part of a compromise deal with Republicans. 2 weeks later, the BP oil rig Deepwater Horizon caught fire and sank, causing the biggest oil spill in U.S. history. In late July, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid pulled the climate bill from further consideration. The domestic U.S. food industry relies on a system of voluntary quality control to ensure food safety. But the Washington Post reports that according to food retail executives and other industry experts, the $1 trillion food industry is rife with corporate conflicts of interest, inexperienced auditors, and cursory inspections that result in inflated ratings. Well-publicized food poisoning outbreaks have exposed the weaknesses in the decades-old system that has food makers hiring private sector auditors, mostly as a preemptive move against possible lawsuits that can damage their brand names. But David Acheson, head of food safety during the Bush administration, called the hiring of private food quality auditors a business strategy and not a public health strategy. Food companies often choose the cheapest auditors to keep inspection costs down and are able to prepare for the audit since they frequently know when the inspection will occur. Over the summer, Wright County Egg in Iowa had a salmonella outbreak that made over 1,800 people sick. 2 months before the incident, Wright Egg received a superior rating from the auditing firm AIB International. The FDA later found poor conditions in the barns of the egg company, including dead maggots and live mice, mounds of manure, and dead chickens in a heap. AIB International never inspected the barns. Hinda Mitchell, a spokesperson for Wright, said they will continue to use AIB International. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
Seventeen years after the Clinton administration imposed the Pentagon's Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy, which barred gays and lesbians from serving openly in the U.S. military, Congress has repealed the measure. In a closely watched debate on December 18th, the U.S. Senate overcame the threat of a Republican filibuster and passed the repeal measure by a 65-31 vote. Gay rights activists and their allies around the country compared the historic vote to President Truman's ending of racial segregation in the U.S. military in 1948. Forceful opposition came from Senator John McCain of Arizona and other Republicans, even in the face of a Pentagon study that concluded that the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell would present a low risk to the military's effectiveness even during a time of war. Another opponent, Marine Corps Commandant General James Amos, stated in congressional testimony that he was particularly concerned about the effect of repeal in combat situations where, he said, gays might be a distraction, which could cost Marines' lives. After President Obama signs the bill into law, the Pentagon must develop and certify a plan for implementing the policy, clearing the way for executing the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell in all branches of the armed forces. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with retired Navy Commander Beth Coy, who talks about her experience as a lesbian serving in the U.S. military for 21 years and the satisfaction she feels having worked hard for many years for the law's repeal.
I joined the Navy as a naval officer in 1960, and that's exactly 50 years ago, would you believe? I had for me to believe. And after toward the end of 1960, I surprisingly to myself fell in love with a naval officer, and it was a woman. I went through a lot of struggles in those days. The culture, our American culture, was still very different about, you know, the issue of gays and lesbians. So, it's, as I say, it's been 50 years, and 21 of those, I was a closeted lesbian and had quite a history there. But because of that experience, when I retired in 1980, during that time, I was always an activist for women in the military and helped women get aboard ship and fly airplanes in my own studious way. I'm a kind of an intellectual type, a Wellesley College graduate, and I did a lot of work for women in the Navy. And then later on upon retirement, especially after 1993 when we had the Don't Ask, Don't Tell law instituted, I said to myself, I've just got to do something. You know, it's just in my heart, I've got to come out and work on this. So I did. I was a founding member of the Service Members Legal Defense Network, which has been one of the leading gay and lesbian organizations to work through this. And we started off as more a group of lawyers working and to help the young men and women who were caught in the middle of this difficult law, shall we say, and then became, in the last 4 or 5 years, a lobby group.
Commander Coy, in your view, will there be some difficulties in implementing this policy, and especially given some of the prejudice that's out there in the ranks of the military, do you fear that when people are open about their sexuality, that there could be a lot more cases of blatant discrimination that take place?
I've thought about that, Scott, and I go back to when we integrated women and African Americans, and yes, you hit it, you nail on the head. It is about prejudice, and there's certainly, it's there, but the reality is, the study, the Pentagon study, showed that probably only 15% of the gays and lesbians on active duty in the military are going to come out. If I were in right now, by the way, I would not come out. I would just talk to my friends, but I wouldn't come out to my boss. You know, just that's not who I am. And most, I think the large majority will not, at least in the first couple of years. So that's one factor. And another factor is the military is terrific in training and education. And I know that already through that study, one of the four pieces of the study was talking about education and training. And we have an equal opportunity offices throughout the military. It'll be their responsibility to provide that training. I'm sure we will do it first class, 4-0, you know, top of the line training. And yes, you'll run into trouble. I ran into trouble when I was, or not trouble, but bumps in the road when I was implementing the Women in the Navy workshops. And I'll never forget this, you know, senior chief petty officers telling me, no, hell no, not on my watch do I want women aboard ship, but look where we are, you know, how many years later, 30, 40 years later, we're doing very well. And yes, we have problems as far as sexual assault on our women, and I'm not proud of that, and we need to do something about that, but as we know, we are all human beings, and that's included in the military, and so we just have to work with it, and I think the military will do it well, and it'll transform within the military. We will have some transformation of attitudes, and the prejudice will gradually lessen, and that too will happen in our nation, in our total country, and that will be a blessing for all of us.
How do you think this victory on Don't Ask, Don't Tell may affect the struggle for equality for gay and lesbian Americans in other areas of our nation's life, such as the right to marry? Do you think there'll be some positive fallout from this?
I believe there will be, but I don't think we should immediately tie everything together. Yes, I do think that equality is equality, and it is an attitude that we are one, and but I do think that there are different issues within each, and the issue of same-sex marriage is a little different from repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell and giving, you know, gays in the military their equality. So hopefully it'll be positive, but it may be a neutral for a while. For instance, myself, I have gradually come around to the fact that it would be a wonderful thing to have same-sex marriage. I'm getting there, but I, due to my age and experience, I at first didn't think that would be such a wise thing for the moment to, you know, and I thought the gay community, the activists could have waited on that, and of course I'm biased because I wanted them to work on repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell, but nonetheless, I think it's a matter of time and we need to absorb all this, but I'd just be cautious as whether this is going to immediately have a positive effect. But I could be wrong. Hopefully I'm wrong, because in the long haul, yes, that's what must come.
That was retired Navy Commander Beth Coy, an active member with the Service Members Legal Defense Network. Call the group at area code 202-328-3244 or visit their website at sldn.org. Activists have been battling mountaintop removal coal mining in Appalachia for many years, and some now have turned their attention to fighting the ravages of natural gas drilling. West Virginia ranks third among states, behind Texas and Pennsylvania, in the number of gas wells, now totaling 48,000. More recently, horizontal gas drilling in the Marcellus Shale Formation has created even more severe scars on the land, and the resulting pollution has threatened drinking water in several states. New York's Governor David Patterson recently imposed a 6-month moratorium on certain kinds of gas drilling in the Marcellus Shale, which extends mostly across parts of New York and Pennsylvania and almost all of West Virginia. Hydraulic fracturing, or fracking, is a gas drilling method in which millions of gallons of water, a secret mix of toxic chemicals and sand, are injected into wells to break apart shale and release trapped gas. The drilling method has polluted groundwater, created contaminated industrial sites in some rural areas, and caused illnesses, according to people who live near fracking operations. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Cindy Rank, a leader of the West Virginia Highlands Conservancy, who has been active in opposing mountaintop removal mining around her home in northern West Virginia, which is now where the bulk of gas drilling in the Marcellus Shale is taking place. Here, she talks about the two issues and recent efforts to better regulate the growing number of natural gas wells.
Many people talk about mountaintop removal being strip mining on steroids, and this new gas drilling is just that. I mean, it's gas drilling on steroids as far as I'm concerned. So that all of the problems that we encountered back in 1980 through the early 80s throughout our area, in addition to the mining that we were fighting, was a lot of the gas drilling, the conventional gas drilling. Most of it was less than 6,000 feet deep. Most of it was more 4,000 feet, whatever. But the footprint and the truck traffic and the impact of pipelines and compressor stations, all of that has increased hundredfold when you get to these bigger Marcellus sites. The impact on the communities and on the earth and on the roads and even in the air, although that's gotten less attention to this point, although I think it's going to be increasing as people have looked at all these different aspects of the drilling. You know, it's just a larger impact all around, whether you're talking about the air or the actual on-the-ground footprint.
Cindy Rank, is the main distinction in drilling in the Marcellus Shale that it's horizontal drilling, or does that go on in other kinds of gas drilling as well?
Well, one, you can do vertical drilling into Marcellus as well as horizontal. When you go down vertical and send out your lateral or your horizontal leg, which you then frack out 3,000 maybe more or less feet, you're getting that much more gas coming up through the well site. So vertical drilling is done into the Marcellus, but it seems to be more efficient to do horizontal drilling.
A lot of people in industry and, you know, even environmentalists point out that natural gas is the cleanest fossil fuel and coal is by far the dirtiest. So natural gas must be the bridge fuel to get us off fossil fuels to clean, renewable energy. So hallelujah.
I can't do hallelujah for this gas. I mean, one of the problems with coal is, you know, the whole life cycle of whatever it is you're talking about is what's important. Visually, there is nothing to compare to mountaintop removal. And it's horrendous and wipes out communities, whole communities. Visually, you're not going to get the same effect, I don't think, from all of this gas drilling. But the individuals like Endemic PA and all of those other places where, strangely enough, their water is impacted, whether or not it's directly a factor of the fracturing or whether the fracturing triggers something else that's already, you know, cracked or not the greatest and allows methane to get up into their wells. I really do believe that there's going to be a very large impact on water, maybe not the same kind as the selenium and everything else we're getting out of the mountaintop removal sites. But I think some of the groundwater resources that many of us depend on for wells and springs, et cetera, may well be impacted by this new gas drilling. But the footprint and the disturbance in the communities, you know, that has to be taken into account. Plus, there are studies that are coming out now that the emissions from these things in terms of greenhouse gas and methane are not as friendly as people would hope that they were. And I guess it's a problem if you're talking about degree of acceptance of fossil fuels. You're already talking kind of devilish choices. It's like, why fossil fuels in the first place, you know? Because when you're talking about fossil fuels, you're talking about finite resources that are really not friendly to extract and to burn. We're finding out that the gas burning isn't as nearly as friendly as we had all hoped. Now, whether or not that makes it a viable bridge option, whether or not it's worth the risk to all of the water resources throughout these areas in the future, you know, I don't know. It's just one of those things I think that we're unprepared for.
That was Cindy Rank of the West Virginia Highlands Conservancy. For more information on both mountaintop removal mining and gas drilling in West Virginia, visit the group's website at wvhighlands.org. In advance of Haiti's November 28th presidential and legislative election, there were calls by many politicians and activists for a delay in the vote, owing to the nation's ongoing earthquake disaster relief and an active cholera pandemic. But President René Préval prevailed, and the election proceeded, with the two top vote-getters unofficially announced as former First Lady Mirlande Manigat and Préval's Unity Party candidate Jude Celestin, who would compete in the second-round January 16th runoff election. However, in the days after the balloting, there were widespread allegations of fraud, and thousands of angry, disenfranchised voters deprived of their vote marched in protest. Musician and presidential candidate Michel Sweet Mickey Martelly was excluded from the runoff election. After supporters engaged in violent demonstrations that left at least four people dead, Haiti's Provisional Electoral Council announced it would recount the ballots. Unhappiness with the election extends to Haiti's largest political movement, the Lavalas Family Party, the base of twice-ousted President Jean-Bertrand Aristide, whose candidates were barred from appearing on the November ballot. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Kim Ives, an editor at the Haiti Liberté newspaper. Ives talks about the outcome of the disputed election and prospects that responsible leadership could emerge to lead Haiti out of its multifaceted humanitarian, economic, and political crises.
The election, which has been called a selection by the Haitian people, actually even before it took place, is taking place in the context of the aftermath of the January 12th earthquake and in the midst of a cholera pandemic, which is sweeping the country already. Some 2,500 people have died and about 120,000 have been infected, and it shows no signs of abating. So many had felt that this was not the best time to hold an election, first of all, but particularly the type of election they were trying to hold. Its first and original, and I could say most important, sin of the Provisional Electoral Council, which was organizing these elections, was to disqualify the largest party in the country, the Lavalas Family Party of exiled former President Jean-Bertrand Aristide, who is still almost 7 years now after the coup d'etat in February 2004 that send him into exile, is still in South Africa, unable to get back. He has no passport, no laissez-passer, as he's requested. So that party was disqualified, which would be the equivalent of, say, disqualifying the Democratic and Republican Party in a U.S. election, and it went forward. Well, most of the population was completely alienated to the process on the basis of that disqualification, even by the KEPs, that's what they call the Provisional Electoral Council, that's its acronym, KEP. Even by the KEPs figures, only 23% of the voting population voted, which is an extraordinarily low number in Haitian elections. Usually it's up more around 99%, because Haitians were denied the right to vote for 30 years under the Duvalier dictatorship, so they really cherish especially the ability to choose the head of state. In any case, among the candidates, and there were 19 of them that ran in this sort of already flawed election, there ended up breaking out a fight, a sort of secondary fight now, between them about who won and was leading. The lead candidate is a woman called Mirlande Manigat, who is the wife of a former puppet president, puppet of the military in 1988. They put him in for about 4 months and then took him out, a guy called Leslie Manigat, who is a right-wing neo-Duvalierist politician, and she is basically seen as a surrogate for him, and he would, in a way, be the power behind her throne if she were to come in. In second place came Jude Celestin, who was the hand-picked protégé successor of René Préval and of the ruling Unité Party. And he nudged out of the January 16th runoff a compas musician by the name of Michel Martelly, known in Haiti as Sweet Mickey, a very famous compas musician who was, in a way, infamous for his very vulgar antics on stage, from dropping his trousers to all sorts of things. Well, Martelly immediately cried fraud. All the other 16 candidates all cried fraud. Then after that, there ended up being all sorts of skirmishes between Celestin's forces and Martelly's primarily in the streets. About five people are said to have been killed in those skirmishes. Right now, the OAS has sort of intervened to say that the final election results, they're going to delay it until they've been reviewed and approved by the OAS. And all of this is just to show how completely controlled these elections are by foreign countries, particularly the U.S., which paid for about half of the $30 million budget of these elections, and essentially is the one ramming them down the people's throats, because for them they really need to cover what is, in essence, a recolonization and a military occupation of the country.
In your view, is there any political figure or movement on the ground in Haiti that could rally the country to confront head-on the still dire situation from the devastation of the earthquake, as well as this current cholera pandemic? Is there any politician, any movement that can work to really get the country moving forward at this point? A tough job, to be sure, but needs to happen.
Well, there's not an individual, there's not a person, but there's a force which is a little incoherent right now, a little embryonic, but it's really an alliance of different movements. These include peasant organizations, sort of traditional left mass organizations, and they are all assembled in a front which is called the Tête Collée Organisation Populaire, the heads together of popular organizations. What it lacks, Scott, is a sort of a solitary organizational structure, because it's really right now a broad front of different organizations. But with time and with the G forces of pressure, political pressure working in Haiti, I think they will begin to merge into a single unified force, and then we'll see the spokesperson of that movement emerge.
That was Kim Ives, an editor at the Haiti Liberté newspaper. Read his articles online in English, French, and Creole at HaitiLiberté.com. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-268-8446 or write to Between the Lines, care of Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut, 06611. Visit our newly redesigned website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.